Oh, okay.
Maybe that should be a bonus.
Oh, you're right.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Chris Vergonis for the appellants. I want to start this morning by touching briefly on the procedural history because I think it's important for the court to understand the significant differences between our now abandoned damages claims and the equitable claims that remain on appeal. This case originally involved, in addition to the two equitable claims that we're continuing to assert, two claims for damages under the Federal Tort Claims Act that took aim at the standard of care used by the government in evaluating the intelligence and selecting El Shifa as the target for the attack. These claims were the focus of the proceedings below and the basis for the district court's conclusion that this case likely was barred by the political questions doctrine. We dropped these claims because of a change in decisional law relating to the ability to recover for injuries occurring abroad, and as a result, the case now is much narrower and it avoids all of the thorny political questions issues that were raised by the damages claims.
Does your APA waiver apply to the president? It doesn't, does it? Just for agencies, right?
Just for agencies and officers of agencies.
Yeah, so what? Let's take the defamation side. What were the defamatory statements made by agents, the alleged defamatory statements made by agency officers? Are there any that come from anything other than media reports and anonymous officials?
They are anonymous.
So how do you know they came from the
Well, we plead that we believe on information and belief that there were officials of the of U.S. agencies, which is broadly defined under the APA, and you know under discovery we'll find out if they were really agents
The United States hasn't conceded that the bombing was a mistake or that the allegations of terror ties are untrue, have they? They haven't conceded that at all.
They haven't conceded that, although a lot of evidence has come out to suggest that in fact. The bombing was a mistake, and they did originally try to freeze Mr. Idris's assets, and then they withdrew that.
But the government officials involved, when they've spoken officially, none of them have conceded that it was a mistake.
That's correct, Your Honor, and they haven't.
In front of the 9/11 Commission, in fact, just reading from their report, President Clinton, Vice President Gore, Berger, Tenet, and Clark insisted to us that their judgment was right, pointing to the soil sample. So my question is, how can we order the relief you've requested without making a determination that the attack was a mistake and that Mr. Idris has no terror ties? How can we do that?
Well, I have two answers to that. First, their position that the judgment wasn't a mistake, I think, relates to this distinction that I was trying to draw at the beginning. You can make a judgment that an attack is warranted based on what you know at the time, and that judgment could be the correct judgment to make, a reasonable judgment to make, even though it turns out the underlying facts were different than you thought. If you see someone approaching you in the dark with what appears to be a gun, you might shoot them in self-defense. That might be reasonable. At the same time, it turns out it was a child with a water pistol. It's a mistake. So I think when the government officials defend their judgment.
What happens when those mistakes are made in the foreign policy area and national security area? Well, it's clear, isn't it? What happens when mistakes are made in those areas?
Well, I think it's clear that it's reviewable and relief can be offered.
My authority for that is?
Well, my authority for that, in the defamation context, we have all these terrorist designation cases, such as National Council for Resistance, Holy Land Foundation, People's Mujahideen, in which this court has reviewed terrorist designations, and
there we have a statutory directive to do so.
Right.
Absent a statutory directive.
Well, I think there are different issues that are raised. The statutory directive, I would submit, is maybe not completely irrelevant to the political questions doctrine, but it doesn't speak to the justiciability of the question. And in fact, in People's Mujahideen, there was a statutory directive, and the court analyzed carefully the issues. And it found that whether the terrorist organization posed a threat to the country was a non-justiciable political question, but whether the organization was in fact a terrorist organization was a reviewable political question. So I think was a reviewable question and not a political question. It was justiciable. So I think the The statutory authorization there goes to the availability of a cause of action. I think we do have a cause of action here for both defamation and our international law cause of action, but it doesn't go to the political questions doctrine, which I think...
Let me give you a hypothetical. What if the United States decided that it was in the national interest to defame somebody?
I think that raises a slightly different question because there's no...
No, this is a hypothetical.
Yeah.
Right? So if the United States decided that it was in its national interest to defame someone...
Because of propaganda? You know, we're going to lie... It's in the national interest to lie about Osama bin Laden and to humiliate him.
Is that reviewable? Would that we be able to review that?
That probably would be an unreviewable political question because there the intended policy is the defamation, and it raises difficult questions about political questions. Here, I don't think there was a policy.
Suppose that the policy is to spread disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not generally, but for some specific reason.
Again, that's how I understood Judge Griffith's question. And
so
I think
now, if we sent this case back to the district court, mm-hmm. the question is whether this was allegedly defamatory statement was shielded from review by virtue of that kind of policy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't put the agency in the position of saying, well, in this case it was disinformation, so we're shielded because that undermines the value of it being disinformation.
Right. Well, I don't want to concede that the agency can spread, that it's unreviewable for the agency to falsely defame people, I mean, citizens of the United States. I don't think the agency can come along and falsely defame them in some sort of national interest. He's not a citizen of the United States. We do allege that he has property interests in the United States, and we think that gives him constitutional standing.
So you're saying disinformation would be what? Reviewable and actionable?
I would submit that it is actionable, but this is a very different case, and even if you found intentional disinformation not actionable, what we have here is a government policy to identify persons as terrorists because the government thinks they are terrorists. So we're not trying to attack any sort of any policy. We have no issue with that policy. We just say they got the wrong guy. They've identified Mr. Idris as a financier of terrorists, and we allege without any evidence of that, and we can prove in court that he is, in fact, innocent.
If this case is remanded, how many seconds will it be before you get a Glomar-type response from the government? That will be the end of it.
What type of response? I'm sorry.
Glomar, they can neither confirm nor deny.
Right. I think we might have to have some discovery to...
It's a state secret. You lose.
We think they could.
You're in a foreign policy, national security area. How can you say you're not? These are there's clear that the decision to bomb mm-hmm. was a national security area, and you're not disputing that.
We're not disputing the decision to bomb. We are saying if the decision to bomb was a mistake, international law requires compensation for the mistake.
And how would a court determine that international law entitles you to compensation? They would have to say it was a mistake, right? I could see maybe if the United States conceded that, but you're talking about a discovery dispute in the courts of the United States over whether a national security decision was made correctly or incorrectly. That's new territory for
us. It's not completely new, Your Honor. I think, first of all, one point that you made, they may dispute it. We think they may not dispute it. We think there's been a lot of evidence.
They've disputed it so far, right?
In
31 note 5, they are very clear. They dispute all of this.
I mean, they've chosen their words carefully, and I think they...
And what's more important, a copy of Mr. Clark's book or the filings made by the United States before this court? Which one should we give?
Well, I think the filings are important, but their point, I think, is the procedural point that they haven't been answered yet, so they didn't technically concede anything. We think that it's going to be hard for the United States to maintain that this was a chemical weapons facility based on what is known now. But even if they dispute it, questions like that are reviewable. The detainee cases that this court and the Supreme Court have been struggling with since 9/11 are decisions where a military decision is made in the battlefield to capture certain people, and those aren't questionable, and no one says that you can bring a negligence suit challenging the standard of care, say, of the battlefield detention decision, but an after-the-fact review to determine whether or not that decision was correct, whether the person in custody is, in fact, a terrorist, or an enemy of the United States is justiciable, and Rasool and Handy and Omar and this court and the Supreme Court.
Who knows what the Supreme Court would do, but I think they'd find it very interesting that their decisions in those settings would be possibly used to second guess a decision to strike a military target.
I don't think it's too far afield at all. Imagine a case where the United States came in and instead of destroying a military target, seized a target and occupied it. So then you have a very similar, very analogous situation to an individual who's being held in custody and subject to continued detention, and a piece of property that's being held in custody and subject to continued detention. I think the principle transposes very easily from the one to the other in that situation. And here, the only different fact is that instead of being held, the facility has been destroyed. But I think, you know, and then there's a legal question about whether we're entitled to any relief because of that.
You're back on your Law of Nations claim.
On the Law of Nations claim, yeah. The Law of Nations claim relates to the destruction of the property.
I have to say, in candor, that I think your time is better spent on the defamation.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. And on the defamation claim, again, I think it's effectively a terrorist designation, which this court has found to be justiciable in cases like People's Mujahideen. We allege that it was a mistaken designation. It was done outside the contours of these formal procedures under the AEDPA and whatnot, so we have to...
You presented two theories for your defamation claim for alternatively the APA.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And the APA claim, you have a problem with Hearst Radio.
We have a problem with Hearst Radio. This court has three times criticized Hearst Radio.
It doesn't matter. I mean,
it's precedent of the court.
It's a panel.
Sure. I think if the panel wanted...
You're right to preserve that for reconsideration by the full court.
But I think what the questioning of the Hearst Radio doctrine suggests, I think, is that the case ought to be read narrowly, and there's room here, I think, where you have a targeted defamation at one individual rather than a government publication.
Which targeted one broadcast.
Yes, but it was generally a publication done in the ordinary course of the FTC's business. This is more, the words are equivalent to a sanction, and this is more sanction-like.
You're saying defamatory leaks are not part of the ordinary business of the
FTC? I guess they probably are, but here it was targeted at a particular individual. I'd submit it's equivalent to a sanction within the words of the APA in a way that the FTC Blue Book was not. But also there's a defamation claim, and the government suggests that there's no such thing as a common law claim for equitable relief against the United States. I think there are several cases of this court. Your Honor wrote the Kirsch decision, which recognized a common law claim for tortious interference. Pierce also recognized a common law claim for defamation. In the Supreme Court, you have McGrath recognizing a common law claim for defamation, and Larson before that drew a distinction between stating a cause of action, a common law claim for equitable relief, in that case conversion, and a waiver of sovereign immunity, which did not exist in Larson, but Section 702 overrules Larson in that regard on the waiver of sovereign immunity. So
you've got an overlay with your common law defamation that if if we say you've got a claim that can go forward, you can't win on the defamation unless it is found that it was a mistake to so brand him.
That's correct. And that's correct. And again,
that's tied to it was a mistake to destroy his
property. I don't think it's tied at all to a mistake to destroy his property, because the original justifications for the destruction of the property were that there was a precursor to nerve gas they thought was found in the soil sample. They thought the plant was owned by a Sudanese government-owned corporation, and they thought they had
some relationship, apparently, with Bin Laden.
So the government says
they've never disavowed that there were chemicals on the site.
Right,
not that it was, they backed off that it was manufacturing, but that it was on the site, right?
They haven't officially disavowed it, although we don't think it's justifiable. But on the defamation claim, it came out after the fact that they were wrong about the ownership of the plant and that Mr. Idris, a private citizen, in fact, owns the company that owns the plant. And as our complaint alleges, these defamatory statements, the government says, based on new information discovered after the bombing, we now think that Mr. Idris, the owner of the plant, has terrorist ties. So this is distinct both temporally and conceptually from the attack on the plane. It wasn't, his alleged terrorist ties were not part of the justification for the attack.
Was that latter statement part of your complaint?
I'm sorry?
The later statement?
Yes, yes. They're all set forth in the complaint in detail, several statements.
But just to clear the underbrush away for the purposes of the last moment of the argument,
okay.
Let's just deal with, let's assume that the only claim, or focus on solely on the claim, that quite apart from the bombing, after the bombing, government officials said what, or allegedly, according to newspapers, said what?
They said, this man, Mr. Idris, who owns the plant, is a financier of terrorist groups like Islamic Jihad, okay. And that he has a close connection with bin Laden, either
those
a partner or an agent.
Those are actual statements that would be tested in a proceeding below.
Those are. And they're similar to statements that this court has, similar to designations, terrorist designations, that this court has reviewed in several cases.
Well, I think you're on sounder ground, frankly, when you forget the terrorist aspect and deal with federal common law cases against the government.
Right, right. I think McGrath, I think, is an excellent case where these groups were designated as communist organizations in the 50s on the Attorney General's list, yeah. And the Supreme Court held that these plaintiffs had, these groups had a defamation claim to get their names off the list. And that's what we're looking for here, a retraction.
Is there anything in the record as to why the government released the assets or unfroze the assets?
There's nothing in the record as to why they dropped the why they did it. We filed a lawsuit, and then they instead of answering the lawsuit, they removed the asset freeze. So you
What's
can infer from that.
What's the criterion for a valid freeze of assets?
I'm sorry?
What is the criterion for a valid freeze of the assets?
I'm sorry, I don't have that handy, Your Honor, but it's a belief that the and individuals involved in terrorism, to some degree. I don't have the standard handy. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is C. Frederick Beckner, and I represent the United States of America. On August 20th, 1998, President Clinton ordered the armed forces to destroy the El Shifa plant in Sudan.
I think we're familiar with that fact.
Well, let me go directly to why our primary argument here, Your Honor, which is this question presents a political question.
I'd like you to address the defamation question, if you
sure.
could jump to that. Why?
What's political about that?
Yeah. Well, what we would say is political about the defamation is for two or three different reasons, Your Honor. First, the justifications given for a military attack are by themselves foreign policy just as much as the attack themselves.
These aren't justifications for the attack. These are after the attack.
The justifications for the military, it was a justification for the military attack.
Well, let's just focus.
They were given 5 days or a week after,
one,
so
one
after the attack.
One of the plaintiff's claims here is that it was a defamatory statement to the effect that he is a supporter and financier of terrorists.
That's correct.
Okay. Quite apart from the destruction, whether the destruction of the plant was correct or not correct. You're saying that that was a false fact, defamatory, it's facially defamatory.
Yes.
Why isn't it triable?
Well, because it is a political question, Your Honor. First, it is a part of the foreign policy of the United States to how we justify military actions.
Well, what did the CIA say when it denied retraction?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What did the CIA say when it denied?
They didn't say anything.
Retraction?
In fact, they didn't
so
put it in.
So it may be that they think that the fact is true.
Could
it may
be
that they don't think they have authority to issue a retraction. It may be any number of reasons they may have had. They didn't say why.
That's correct. But it
how
is.
How do we know it's because of any foreign policy concern?
Well, whether the CIA denied retraction may not have been for foreign policy concern, but it's certainly the case that justifications for military action are an important part of the foreign policy.
What about justification for calling someone a terrorist?
Well, it was in the context of justifying why it was acceptable for us to use military action against El Shifa and destroy it. And moreover,
but at the time it was bombed, they thought it belonged to the Sudanese government. They didn't even know this.
Well, that is the point of say that. That is the allegation.
That's what we're here on.
Right, that's what we're here on. But you don't have to accept. You don't just, while we have to accept their allegations, that doesn't mean you blind yourself to what would have to be discovered and inquired into in the case below. So they would have to then show that based on the military intelligence of the time, they didn't know he owned it, and they didn't know he owned it. And moreover, it is undisputed that he does own it. So there's no way which you could logically say it is defamatory to say that he was associated with chemical weapons and not call into question whether El Shifa itself was associated with chemical weapons, which is exactly what the president said.
And that would, if that were true, that would substantiate the claim that was, or the statement that's ensued here, that he was a financier of terrorists?
I'm sorry, Ron, I didn't quite understand your question.
The statement we're focused on is that he was a supporter and financier
right.
of terrorists, right? And if the chemical weapons evidence is, when we refer to the chemical evidence, does that show that he was indeed a financier or a supporter of terrorists?
Well, it wouldn't show directly he was a financier or supporter of terrorists,
except in the sense that if
El Shifa was involved in the production of chemical weapons and he owned El Shifa, then he is associated with the production of chemical weapons, which is what...
But it could have been for the government of Sudan.
What?
For the government, it could have been for the government of Sudan.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
The production of chemical
weapons. It could have been for...
Doesn't mean that he's supporting terrorists. It means he could have been supporting the government of Sudan. We don't know.
Well, he could have been associated with the production of chemical weapons. The president said El Shifa was involved in the production of chemical weapons for Al-Qaeda specifically. That is what the president said.
Right.
So there's no way in which you could say the owner of a plant had no association with chemical weapons or no association with bin Laden, but at the same time not call into question whether the plant itself was being used for chemical weapons.
Is the statement in the complaint regarding the statement attributed to a government official after the bombing saying that Idris is a supporter of terrorists, is that attributed to the president?
No, it's not attributed to the president.
So it's not the president's statement that's ensued here.
I disagree for one reason, Your Honor, and that is the relief they're seeking, that it is defamatory to say that Mr. Idris was associated with chemical weapons production or bin Laden would naturally call into question President Clinton's statements that El Shifa itself was associated with chemical weapons and associated with bin Laden.
Well,
and moreover,
so what? Can the king make no mistake?
Well, I'm not saying the king can't make no mistake, but that then is clearly a political question, that calling into the foreign affairs powers are vested in the president and the political branches, and this court, there's no precedent suggesting this court could call into question the military decision by the president to destroy it.
Of course not. The military decision is off the table in this discussion. What do you do with the McGrath case, the Joint Anti-Fascist case?
Well, what I would say there, Your Honor, I mean, it's hard to make heads or tail of what the actual holding is, but to some degree it's a due process.
Well, that's not to defame the Supreme Court.
No, not to defame the Supreme Court, Your Honor. To a large degree, I think it's a due process decision, and this court has characterized it as a due process decision. Here, the plaintiff has not asserted any due process rights under the Constitution, and in our view, has no constitutional rights. But moreover, at the time, under McGrath, the claims were brought against the individuals, not against the sovereign, and the Supreme Court, applying Larson, has held that the allegations in the complaint were such that you could not cloak the individuals with the sovereign immunity of the United States, that they acted so ultra-virously, if that's a word, I apologize, that they no longer enjoyed sovereign immunity. So it was a case against the individuals in their individual capacity.
I'm advised by the miracle of modern communications that in Pierce, the court characterized McGrath as a common law defamation.
Okay, well, I apologize. And I'm referring to, I think, one of the terrorist designation cases where it seemed to indicate that it considered it to be a due process case. But even if it's a common law defamation case, it was still brought against the individuals, and the case was allowed to proceed because...
So if this case were restyled as El Shifa Pharmaceutical Industries versus six unknown employees of the United States, that would suffice?
Well, then it would clearly fall. The Westfall Act is currently in effect. McGrath was decided before the Westfall Act. So if they brought a constitutional claim, then the Westfall Act may or may not apply. If it's a constitutional claim, the Westfall Act actually would not apply. They would have a constitutional claim against the individuals. then you would have to determine whether you should imply a cause of action under Bivens. And here, I think Judge Scalia.
I don't see a constitutional claim.
They don't have a constitutional claim here, but I'm just, but I wanted to make the claim that Judge Scalia's opinion in Sanchez-Espinosa forecloses that line of argument. There, that was basically the same line, that was the argument being made there, applying a Bivens cause of action in foreign policy context. Judge Scalia said, we were not going to do that. We're not going to apply Bivens cause of action for allegations by aliens challenging the exercise of foreign policy abroad.
And this would not be a Bivens action?
No, it would not be. No, right. But they don't have, but I'd like to turn to their cause of action. They say they have action under the common law. Well, what common law are they talking about? If it's federal common law, it's established since Erie. The federal courts do not have the authority to establish and develop substantive federal common law. So
that was established for about 15 minutes, as Judge Friendly pointed out.
Well, but there's no substantive federal common law. They don't point to a established federal common law of defamation that they could bring their claims on, let alone established federal common law of defamation that would apply against the sovereign.
Well, it's true that we're not sure here whether we're talking about federal or local common law.
Well, it can't be local common law because they have no jurisdiction under 1331, Your Honor. There's no federal cause of action under state common law. There's no jurisdictional grant for that. So they brought their claim under 1331. Presumably, they're arguing in favor of federal common law. There is no substantive federal common law of defamation that they, let alone one that has been determined to apply against the United States. And under Meyer,
why wouldn't the D.C. action come into under the supplemental jurisdiction?
Well, first of all, they haven't alleged it. Second of all, if they were bringing a state, just a pure state common law of action, that raises a host of issues under Myers and Flamingo. Industries that under those precedents, the courts are supposed to determine whether the law, Congress, not only has there been a sovereign waiver of sovereign immunity, but whether the law applies to the United States. Here they would be saying that the United States agencies are bound by 50 state laws in the APA could apply.
But if the actors here are individuals and if they were determined to be acting beyond the scope of their office,
then the individuals could be sued under state common law. And the Westfall Act would not apply if they were outside the scope
of
their authority.
So you really would push them back again to have some John Doe defendants here?
Well, I guess in a sense, yes, but they haven't sued them. And to the extent they have a claim, I guess I would say it would be a state law claim. Now, if the Westfall Act did apply, then the Federal Tort Claims Act would clearly bar their claim because the libel and slander is barred under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Your Honor, have any more questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Do you have time? I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. The government says it's logically impossible to rule on the defamation claim without calling into question the bombing. The soil sample was taken in late 1997. Where they purported to find chemicals in the ground. Mr. Idris purchased the plant later in March 1998, and the attack occurred in August 1998. Could be that the plant was a chemical weapons facility before Mr. Idris purchased it, and I don't think a defamation claim or a ruling in his favor would call that into question at all. Second, on the McGrath-Larson point.
Is that undisputed?
It's allegations of our complaint. I think it's undisputed. It's in the public record as well. The Westfall Act relates to claims for damages. These are equitable claims. In McGrath, the claim was brought against individuals under the Larson exception to sovereign immunity, which barred equitable claims against the government. Section 702 overruled Larson. In that regard, there's no longer a sovereign immunity bar to equitable claims, equitable common law claims against the government. There's no need to go after individuals. And all this talk about the Westfall Act and Bivens, those are money damages claims. These are equitable claims. They're analyzed under the waiver of Section 702. So they can be brought here under the authority of cases like Pierce and Kirch, which recognize common law claims against the United States, whether they're probably governed by federal law under Kimball Foods. Claims against the United States are governed by federal common law. There's some question of choice of law here, whether it's a unique federal law or whether the common law incorporates the rules of the state governments. That hasn't been briefed below. If you look at footnote 3 of Justice Scalia's opinion in Boyle, he talks about the distinction between incorporating local rules of decision or setting a single federal standard. But it's a federal question. It's a claim against the United States, so it's properly here against under 1331.
What did McGrath, what common law defamation did McGrath apply?
It didn't get that far in terms of choice of law principles. It just held the claim was dismissed below on justiciability grounds, and they held it was justiciable. And then they went back to the lower courts for further proceedings. So they didn't say whether it was federal defamation law or local defamation law.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Beckner, thank you. Case is submitted.
Stand, please. This honorable courthouse stands adjourned.